The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We are live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Charmack. Coming up on today's programme. Anti-government protests in Burkina Faso's capital city and a possible military coup, as reports emerge of gunfighting and of the president being detained. We'll have the latest from Ouagadougou. Then the UK joins the US in asking staff in Kyiv to leave the embassy as tensions with Russia continue to grow. Is it a sign that an invasion is inevitable? Also up ahead.
Hello, my name is Anna Rosenberg. I'm head of Signum UK and Europe, and a little bit later today on the program I will be talking about Friedrich Merz as the new head of the CDU-CSU and what it means for German politics.
We'll have more from Anna in a short while. And the French fashion designer Thierry Mugler, famous for giving women all around the world the power look, has died at the age of 73. We'll remember his life and legacy. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Charmack. We start today in Burkina Faso, where a possible military coup is underway. The president has been detained at a military camp by mutinying soldiers, who are demanding more support for their fight against Islamist militants. This follows heavy gunfire at various military barracks throughout all of yesterday. Well, let's get the latest on this from the capital, Ouagadougou now. Sam Mednick, a peace correspondent in Burkina Faso, joins us from there. Hello, Sam. Welcome to The Briefing. Thanks for joining us from a fast-moving story and place today. I mean, what can you tell us, first of all, about what's happening on the ground?
Hi, so thanks for having me. Right now, the situation is quite fluid. Yesterday, there were gunshots at military bases in Ouagadougou, and soldiers that I spoke to said they had taken over the bases and they had demands of the presidency. And then later in the evening, there were more gunshots. And right now, they have said that they have detained the president, although we don't know where he is, and that they have taken over and we're waiting for a statement on the state broadcaster. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now. It's unclear exactly what is happening, but some of the soldiers I've spoken to say that part of the coup say that the president is detained and that he's in a safe place.
Well, and on the government side, as you say, waiting for a statement, but the government has denied that a military coup is taking place. I mean, how significant is this news of the president being detained?
Well, it's quite significant. We haven't heard from the government since yesterday when the Minister of Defense spoke and said that the situation was under control, admitted that there was gunshots at some of these bases, but that there wasn't a coup. However, the situation since then has evolved, and we haven't heard anything from the president or the government since then. And we're expecting to hear a statement from the mutinied soldiers on state broadcasting system. And they've heavily surrounded the state broadcaster with tanks and trucks and lots of armed men.
So it does sound like they've made serious inroads in that sense. I mean, tell us a little bit about what is this about? What has the army been demanding and why is the government not giving in?
The army, what they told me yesterday when I saw some of them, they're demanding, they wanted the intelligence and the military hierarchy to step down. They want a special unit to fight the jihadists. In general, they're just exacerbated. They're upset. They are losing a lot of people. They're frustrated. A lot of people say the government has had no strategy as they're fighting jihadists that are sweeping across the country and taking territory. And they're just angry and fed up. And the government has tried to, the government has changed the cabinet. Last month, the president fired his prime minister and reshuffled most of the cabinet. However, people just say that's not good enough and it's too late. And they need a change, and they think military rule is the answer at the moment.
Okay, so military rule, but not necessarily the military that's currently in place. Do I understand you right on that? So there would be, it's sort of, this is a mutiny, not of the military's leadership, but of lower level who would like to take over.
The people that I've spoken to say that it's higher level, lower level military. However, there are some higher level people on board. But the criticism is that the higher level people and the people in government, that they are disconnected from their forces in the field and that they don't care about them. So it's a mix of changing up the military hierarchy, but also saying that the president, being the head of the country, has had no strategy and that he needs to go as well.
And what is your sense then of that disconnection that you mentioned there? I mean, how serious is the fight against Islamist insurgents, and how has it been going?
It hasn't been going very well. As the soldiers say, they have lost a lot of people. And this is a country that was at peace for the longest time. So this is very new to most of the people fighting, and they are devastated. They are losing a lot of ground. Oh, since the 2 years that I've been here, the area of the country that you can travel in safely has gotten a lot smaller. At places you could drive to, you now have to fly to. And so the fight is not going well. The soldiers I've spoken to say they're having a really hard time fighting the jihadists. They don't know who to fight. They do guerrilla tactics, the jihadists, and they don't know how to deal with that. They're not equipped enough. They're not trained enough. So there's a lot of criticism towards the government, and it's a hard fight in general. And at the moment, it's not going very well.
Well, and tell us a little bit about the civilian side then, as opposed to the soldiers. What has the local reaction been like to this? There have been, as we understand, anti-government protests, demonstrations as well.
Yes, so there have been a series of really deadly attacks from June and in the fall, and that sparked civilians to come to the street and protest, demanding that the president resign. There was one in November, and there was also one on Saturday, right before the gunshots started in the military bases. And so the civilians that I speak to are in support of this. They say it's time for a change. We're not happy with the government, and they're on board. There's 1.5 million displaced people in the country. Thousands of people have died, and they're upset as well.
Well, I mean, given that, then I guess this is always a question when these kinds of things happen. But it sounds like you're saying even civilians would be in favor of a military coup at this point. Is that sort of how desperate the situation is, that democracy is not the priority at the moment?
From the people that I've spoken to here, that's what I've heard, that they are happy to have the military take over. They think the country needs to be led by military right now to deal with the situation. And some people have even said to me, democracy doesn't work for us. We don't need that right now.
Well, we'll continue to monitor this story. Thanks very much, Sam. That was Sam Mednick, who is AP's correspondent in Burkina Faso. She was on the line from the capital, Ouagadougou. Now, here's Monocle's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. At least 70 people have been arrested in Brussels after protests against vaccine passports turned violent. Some 50,000 people had taken to the streets, with some throwing rocks and destroying property, including the entrance to the EU's Foreign Representative's office. 3 police officers and 12 demonstrators were injured in the clashes. The United States has told diplomats' families to leave Ukraine in the latest sign yet that the West is bracing for a Russian invasion of its neighbour. It comes amid increasingly stern warnings of consequences from Western nations. We'll have more on this story later in the programme. The Italian Parliament has begun voting for a new president. Current Prime Minister Mario Draghi is among the leading candidates, but there are also fears that his ascendancy to the presidency could provoke a new political crisis. A first round of voting today appears unlikely to produce a conclusive result. And the Alacitas Festival starts in La Paz today, and we'll see thousands of Bolivians turn out to buy everything they want for the coming year in miniature form. From fake marriage certificates to miniature houses, the hope is that buying these pint-sized dreams will encourage the gods to convert their wishes into the real deal. For more on this curious festival, you can head over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Paige. Well, as we've just heard in the headlines, tensions are escalating over the situation on Ukraine's border with Russia. The UK has now joined the US in ordering some of its staff and dependents to leave the embassy in Kyiv. In the meantime, members of NATO, including Denmark, Spain, Bulgaria and the Netherlands, are sending more fighter jets and warships to Eastern Europe to bolster defences in the region. The EU is stepping up its warning of unprecedented sanctions if Russia does indeed go ahead with an invasion. Well, for more on this, I am joined by Stephen Diao. He's a Russia analyst and regular Monocle 24 contributor here in the studio. Stephen, always good to have you on. Let's just start with, how significant is this move to tell diplomats, families, dependents, some staff to leave? A precaution or a sign that we really are in the end game, as it were, here?
I think the crucial word you've just used there is sign. It's a sign both to the Western powers, NATO countries, European countries, that the US and the UK take the apparent threat from Russia seriously. It's also a sign to Vladimir Putin that whatever he's saying, whatever his foreign minister said, what is coming out of the Kremlin saying, no, there's not going to be an invasion, that they don't actually believe what he's saying, and they're right not to believe it. There is far too big a record of Putin and his fellow leaders of Russia lying about what they intend to do. Go back to 2014 when Putin denied that the soldiers that took Crimea were his, and then a year later said, yeah, I gave the order the last day of the Olympics, the Winter Olympics in Sochi. So it is a sign both ways. But the one person who's winning in this at the moment is Putin. Putin's main aim right now, given that an invasion hasn't taken place, is to destabilize Europe, to have the West worried about what's going on. And so diplomats being withdrawn from Kyiv shows him that his plan at the moment is working. He still can twiddle his thumbs and decide whether he's going to send the troops in, but he's certainly got everyone worried. He's certainly got everyone concerned about what's going to happen next, and that suits him.
Well, okay, so that suits Putin, but I guess what is striking about this story at the same time is that even just a few weeks ago, it felt like people assumed Russia would not actually invade and was using all of this as a bargaining chip. In a way, you're still saying that is what's happening, but at the same time, I mean, are we underestimating Vladimir Putin? Are we really at a stage now where are we sleepwalking into invasion? What is there anything that can stop this?
There is nothing else, I think, that the West can do to stop this, apart from what they're doing. So the withdrawing of diplomats is one thing. Far more significant was the other part of the headline story, that more equipment, more military equipment, fighter jets, warships going to the Black Sea, that equipment going from NATO countries into Eastern Europe, that's a more significant sign to Putin that, you know, we're not just running away, we're not taking diplomats out, we are actually stepping up possible military cooperation, military help to Ukraine. Of course, they've said right at the start, very, very early on in this, President Biden said that the US would not send troops to Ukraine, which I've often felt was a mistake to state that so blatantly, even if he didn't intend to do it. Don't tell the other side one of your key moves isn't going to, possible key moves isn't going to happen. But at the same time, the fact that the West is signalling that it is prepared to help Ukraine in some way, that it's not just going to stand by and let this happen, that's a very significant move.
Well, significant, but at the same time, even there, as you say, it seems like NATO is moving assets to the region, to Eastern Europe. But of course, it also has said it will not defend Ukraine itself. So in that sense, too, how much do you feel that even if Vladimir Putin will take that kind of threat seriously? Or does he perhaps feel, well, I can take part of Ukraine, just not any other part of Europe?
That's the real danger, I think, still. I may be proven wrong, but I think that the idea of a mass invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces is unlikely, even though, for example, we've in the last week or so had Russian forces moving into Belarus, which of course is to the north of Ukraine and indeed to the north of Kiev, the capital. They say to carry out exercises with the Belarusian army. So Ukraine has been not quite surrounded because, of course, they can't come from the west, but to the north, to the east, warships in the Black Sea, many, many troops in Crimea. There are troops on three sides of Ukraine, Russian troops. So that is definitely a worry. But I think the idea that if there's going to be a move, that it's going to be strengthening the Donbass, the region that Russia effectively controls already in eastern Ukraine, possibly trying to link up that area with Crimea, because at the moment they're two very separate areas. Crimea is a peninsula. It stands alone, as it were, has been taken by Russia 8 years ago. But there is a territorial gap between that and the Donbass. And one of the things that has been discussed over the 8 years is, would Russia try and join them up so that it would have a larger chunk of territory that it's in control of? And that remains, I think, a very serious concern.
Well, and on that point, even Joe Biden, in a possible flub last week, suggested that a sort of minor incursion would not necessarily draw a severe reaction. So I guess on that point then, if we're talking about eastern Ukraine, incursions into that region, joining up that region with Russia, what do you expect the response to be to that, even if there isn't a full-blown invasion of the entire Ukraine?
Well, I would hope not what President Biden suggested. I hope it was a rather poor choice of words in answer to a question from a journalist at a press briefing, because certainly Mr. Blinken from the State Department suggested that actually, no, it's more serious than that. Another thing I just want to put in here, though, is what a drum I've banged very often, and indeed in this studio, is that Putin's favourite game is Go. It's not chess, it's Go. And when you play Go, you can play on a board of different sizes and you can operate in different parts of the board. Now, not only is Putin playing on a Ukraine-sized board at the moment, so the troops to the north in Belarus, that's one move, the ones in the east, the ships in the Black Sea, these are all destabilizing factors. But I think another thing to look out for is if there is some sort of incursion, watch what will be happening in Western Europe. There will be demonstrations probably in favor of Russia, curiously. We know that for years Russia has been funding any party, extreme right, extreme left, that has been favorable to Russia or indeed against the democratic institutions of the West. And this is all part of the game as well. This is all part of his massive game of Go. So I think that it suits him if we simply look at Ukraine and take it in isolation. It really must be seen as a Europe-wide problem.
It really is incredible how many different pieces in this Go puzzle there are. Stephen Diao, thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. If at first you don't succeed, try, try and try again. That appears to be the lesson from Germany, where a familiar face has taken over the opposition Christian Democratic Union. The conservative MP Friedrich Merz has been elected to lead the CDU party over the weekend after multiple failed attempts in the past 2 decades. Merz promises a new beginning for the party, and it's fair to say that he will not be carrying the same line as the party's longtime leader Angela Merkel, who of course stepped down at the end of last year. Well, for more on this, I am joined by Anna Rosenberg, who is the head of Europe and the UK at the consultancy Signum Global. Anna, welcome to the show. Let's start with who Friedrich Merz is, a longtime figure in German politics, but just remind us a little bit about him.
Yes, so Friedrich Merz is a representative of the more conservative wing of the CDU, the so-called Werteunion, the Union of Values. He has been really an opposite to Angela Merkel for quite some time in German domestic politics. And he was representing a wing of the CDU that didn't really have a lot of power during the Merkel era. And now he's had a comeback, which kind of makes sense given the political direction of Germany right now. His background is certainly more conservative. He has worked for BlackRock for quite a few years recently, which has made him a multimillionaire. And he stands in contrast to the previous leaders that we have seen in the CDU in the past couple of years.
Well, as you said there, the mood perhaps has shifted. This, of course, follows the CDU's defeat in last September's Bundestag elections. I mean, are you surprised in that sense by how much of a shift there is, the fact that he hadn't managed to succeed before, but now is? I mean, what does that say about the mood in the party?
Well, it's interesting because in a way the CDU has been divided for quite some time. Angela Merkel had moved the CDU and the CDU's policies really constantly more to the center-left, and she had subsumed many of the center-left political ideas. And that worked for her politically and the CDU. As a result, they have been in power for 16 years now. But it did not work for the conservative part of the CDU electorate. And it in the past, it was also blamed that the shift for the CDU has meant that you had a right-wing party emerge on the fringes, the AfD. And so in a way, the transition now makes sense because now we have a social democratic government in place and there is a need for a differentiated opposition. And now, as an opposition, the CDU will have the opportunity to position itself with a very unique profile.
A unique profile, as you suggest there. I mean, given that then, I mean, he was elected over the weekend with 94% of the vote. But as you say, he has always been a divisive figure, even within the party. How much support do you really feel he has?
Well, he certainly has a support amongst the party and the party base. And the party base has been quite disenchanted recently with this kind of move towards the center-left that I've outlined earlier. In regards to his support in the population, I would not expect him to be a particularly popular figure. He is not necessarily be seen as a newcomer or as someone who, you know, will get a lot of support from female voters, for example, or from environmentally conscious voters. So he may have the support now within the party, but beyond that, his support will be limited. And it's important, though, that we'll talk about how he's going to position the party in opposition, because he's going to try to capitalize from rising inflation and from a changing mood that is possible to occur in German politics. And in that, if the environment changes, and we can talk about this if you want, Chris, then there is indeed scope for Merz to become more popular.
Well, let's talk not just about how the environment might change, but what exactly do you think that looks like for Friedrich Merz? What kind of policy is he going to be focusing on to differentiate himself?
So we are now in a very interesting time in German and indeed in European politics, because we've gone through the pandemic and we have seen European governments, and with the new German government too, increasingly embracing more fiscal inclusion on the EU level. They are really not that bothered anymore about high debt levels, about being prudent fiscally. Indeed, we are now talking about reforming the EU's fiscal policy. And all of this will lead towards a much laxer attitude to public spending and a fiscal attitude generally. And the new German finance minister, Christian Lindner, claims that he wants Germany to stick to the black zero and the balanced budget. But in reality, he won't, because there's a huge need for Germany to step up its investments in the economy and to take on more debt. Now, that is going to be a very good line of attack for Friedrich Merz, because he represents a party of fiscal conservatism. And now we have rising inflation, in which voters are going to get concerned again around rising interest rates and what that could mean for debt. And so Merz is going to beat the drum about the new government being fiscally irresponsible, about debt levels rising not just in Germany, but across the EU. And if inflation continues to rise, and if interest rates increase as well, then he may very well start to get more attention from voters.
Well, so he'll start to get more attention. There is, of course, a lot of time now between now and the next German election. What is your sense of how Friedrich Merz will he even be the candidate for the German conservatives, do you think, going forward? What does he have to do in the meantime? Of course, there is this peculiarity of the conservatives in Germany that the CDU leader doesn't necessarily become the chancellor candidate. There is this sister party, the Christian Social Union, and their leader, Markus Söder. He is very popular. What will his role be, and who do you expect will actually lead this party going forward?
It's indeed. It's still a couple of years' time, so it's too early to tell. I think a lot of the success will depend on the of Merz's success will depend on this narrative that I outlined around inflation and interest rates increases working in his favor, which is not a given. And I guess the power struggle between Merz and Söder will, you know, increase for sure. Söder is very clearly wanting that job as next German chancellor, but historically, there has never been a CSU leader who has really succeeded at the national election. A Bavarian leader is just simply not as popular on national grounds. However, it's also important to point out that by not choosing Söder, the CDU have probably done themselves a disfavor in the last election. And so his path looks more promising. Söder's path looks more promising. At this point in time, I would not rule out Merz or project that Söder is going to take the post as leader of the CDU-CSU at the next election. It's too early to tell.
It is too early, but we will continue to follow this story, of course. Anna Rosenberg, thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monaco 24. It is coming up on 13:25 in Paris, 12:25 here in London. This is The Briefing. Finally today, we remember the life and legacy of French designer Manfred Thierry Mugler, who has died at the age of 73. Mugler was at the forefront of the 1980s power dressing look and has served as an inspiration for generations of designers. Well, joining me now to look back on his influence and work is the Paris-based fashion journalist Dana Thomas, who's also the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Dana, welcome, as always, to the show. Let's start just with, why was Mugler such an iconic figure?
Well, we loved Thierry for many things. One was his extravagance in design and in life. You know, he was a bodybuilder, so he was sort of a big guy in the world of fashion, where, you know, skinny reigns. But also, he just had this enormous creativity and touched in all these different areas of culture, not just fashion. He did set design, he did costume design, he created costumes for Macbeth for the Comédie Française, where he dressed the three witches in nude latex. He did costumes for Beyoncé for her concert tours. He had put on a huge extravaganza of a show called The Wild in Berlin that was, you know, one of the most popular shows of all time. And he, you know, he did all sorts of crazy outlandish fashion for his own couture line, like dressing Nadja Armin like R2-D2 and being inspired by nature and creating these crazy animal-like creatures, like bugs and butterflies, out of crystals and sequins to be worn on the runway. It was just, he was fun. You know what he was? He was fun.
He was fun. And I mean, reading also some of what you've written about him in the past, you've also interviewed him. It's striking in a sense that he was fun before the era of, as you've written, sort of Instagram, and when we really sort of looked for these kinds of fun images and so on. I mean, what in that sense was, do you feel, his influence on the fashion world?
Well, he had a lot of influence in that he put on extravaganza, you know, these big fashion shows, and which I think, you know, led us directly to John Galliano's fashion shows for Dior that were big productions, and Alexander McQueen's big production fashion shows. You would have never been able to pull those off, get the budget to do them, had Thierry Mugler not already had James Brown performing Sex Machine at his, or having Pat Cleveland descend from a ceiling dressed as a Virgin Mary in smoke, you know, for his. He did these crazy blown out fashion shows before they were a thing to do. And he also was the one who took the idea of designer perfume to a whole new level with his perfume Angel, which was one of the best-selling perfumes of all time. And he photographed the campaigns himself, and he would shoot these ad campaigns for his fashion and his perfume you know, by putting models on top of the Chrysler Building or on top of the Paris Opera House in just these spectacular settings, he really, really pushed the limits and therefore gave permission to a whole new generation of younger designers to keep going.
So spectacular settings, as you described there. One other thing, I mean, famous for giving women all around the world the power look. Tell us more about that.
Well, yes. Back in the 1980s, we were all wearing power looks, not just from Mugler, but, you know, Saint Laurent was doing it. And you know, thanks to Nancy Reagan, who was this tiny little woman, but wanted to appear taller and bigger and more powerful. So she brought back the power suit from the 1940s, which, mind you, was created for Joan Crawford for the same reason, because she was a tiny little woman who wanted to appear bigger on screen. So the big shoulders came back in fashion thanks to Nancy Reagan. And man, oh man, did Thierry Mugler take it to a whole nother level. He made those shoulders like linebacker shoulders with little wasp waists like Jessica Rabbit's. And, you know, he made women look really powerful and really domineering and but yet sexy and feminine. It was kind of like what you see in what we call in French BD, the bande dessinée, you know, I guess graphic novels, where women are just like these glamazons who will take you out, but they will do so in, you know, seamed stockings and these power suits and jackets and dresses with plunging necklines, and they're really looking hot. So you want to be careful, because they will kill you with their stiletto heels.
incredible stuff. I mean, well, just Dana, finally, I mean, you had a chance to interview him just last year as part of a retrospective exhibition that was in Paris, or is in Paris. Just tell us, what was he like? Did the personality match the extravagance you're describing, I suppose?
Yes, he was very friendly. He had this wonderful, deep, gravelly voice down here like this, and he spoke beautiful English. And he's lived in Berlin these last years, and he had taken up bodybuilding, as I said, so he was really fit and looked fantastic. So, you know, losing him was kind of a surprise for me, learning this morning, because he seemed to be in really good form when I saw him in September. And he was at the heart of his big party, 1,000 people in the Louvre Museum of Musée des Arts Décoratifs, you know, right at that sort of minute where we were allowed to have parties again before COVID came raging back. And he sat there all night receiving people like a king. Cardi B was with him in an explosion of scarlet plumes that he'd designed for, you know, like, it was just such an over-the-top evening. And he seemed in great form and hilarious. He was just hilarious. We had a laugh. We had a really good laugh just talking about fashion in the 80s and the 90s and everything that he'd been doing.
Well, Dan, it really sounds like he's going to have quite an impact on you and on the world of fashion even going forward. And so thanks so much for talking to us about him and his background. That was the fashion journalist and author, Dana Thomas. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our studio manager today was David Stevens. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, same place. I am Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.